there are certain things, I mean, no, no, no. There's certain things that are like necessities for human beings, I think. One is food, Arizona iced tea, things like that, you know? I mean, those are obvious necessities. Like, after you go for about a day or 2 days without them, then you start to feel the need for them. And then I think that the motivation behind bodhicitta, the motivation behind that, that kind of compassion is sort of a human need. And you know, I've been in, recently in Russia and in China. And in Russia, they used to have religion, and then it got stomped out. And then it got replaced by communist morality, which is pretty strict. And then recently, I was there in '90, and then I've been going every year since then, or a couple times a year. And then we have monks working there, and it's very noticeable that people are starving for something. You know, like they have enough to eat. In 1990, you couldn't get anything to eat in St. Petersburg. Now you can get anything you need to eat, but now people, they have some other kind of hunger, and you can really see it. I mean, I'm not like Billy Graham, you know? You can really feel it. If you walk around with robes on or something, and at least 20 people will stop you and start asking you, because they don't have anything. You know, like, communist morality is gone, whatever they had before that is gone, and people are, like, starving. And it's very noticeable. In this country, there's, like, people doing semi-spiritual practices and things like that. I mean, we have something. We have churches and temples and things like that. I mean, St. Petersburg is nothing. There's nothing to go to. And when they see a monk, they, like, mob you. And it's really strange. And, like, you're in the subway, and everyone's reading every kind of imaginable New Age spiritual book, you know. And people are starving. It's very interesting. Then you go to China, it's the same thing. There are all these underground crescents that we're working with in China. In China, not in Tibet. And they're cranking out like truckloads of Buddhist texts every day, and like sneaking them around. There's like six of them going. And they produce, I don't know, 500,000 books a month or something. And they just go, because people need something, you know. And I think the capacity to love people, the capacity to have compassion is a human need. And I think you feel it when you come to this class. I think you're expressing some kind of need. You know, it's like hunger, and you need. I mean, people, when you hear about the idea of a bodhisattva, and then you heard about it for a while, and then you heard about bodhisattvas doing incredible things and giving people their bodies, or giving people their eyes, or just living their whole lives for other people. There's something very attractive about it. They say if you have certain seeds in your mind, that you'll be very attracted by that idea. And you would even, like, get goosebumps and chills up your spine when you hear about it. But Madhyamika Avatara says that in the opening chapter. And there's some kind of attraction to the idea that you could get compassion. You know, like, we don't have it. Like, I get irritated on the way here. You know, it's like people on the street, like people, stupid people on the street. I was on the bus the other night. There's just stupid people on the bus. And the last thing I was thinking about was to be good to them or be nice to them, but there's some kind of human need that you have to do it, and you know it, and you feel it, and you sense it, that you would like to be like that, and you're attracted to the idea. You can't do it right now, but I think everyone in this room would, in the back of your heart, you would really like to be like that. You know, you would like to be so compassionate that if someone asked you for your eyeball, you could just reach into the socket without hesitating and just hand it, you know, take it out and hand it to them or something. I mean, you're very much attracted by, you know, if you saw Braveheart, you know, the guy at the end, you know, he has someone who's able to just overcome all the hesitations and just give their body or give themselves to somebody. It's very attractive. Like, it's a very exciting idea. I mean, it gets really something wonderful about it, and you sense it, and you would like to be able to do it, and you'd like to have that kind of compassion. You know, you hear about, there's this bodhisattva in the 8,000 verses called the Dr. Mueller, and he's always crying. He's like crying all the time. Why he's crying, we'll talk about tonight. It's not what you think. But anyway, I mean, you hear just the name. You hear the name, you know, the voice doctor that couldn't stop crying. And it's just attractive. You know, it's just something that it's kind of like, gee, I'd like to learn to do that. It's like seeing some great dancer or seeing some great singer and thinking, well, I'd really like to be able to do that, you know. And I think everybody in this room, you get the smell of it. You get the sense of it. It's attractive. There's something very attractive about it. But there's no, like, school for compassion. You know, there's no, like, you can sign up at NYU or FIT and, you know, Compassion 101, you know, and you can go and, you know, they'll start you off and then you get a master's in it and you get a PhD in it. And there's no school like that. You know, there's nobody teaching it like that. And you're kind of wondering, you know, how can some? I would like to learn to be like that. I would like to learn to love another person as much as I love myself. You know, and that's like some kind of holy grail. You know, it's like some kind of goal that would be really nice if you could care about other people as much as you care about yourself. I mean, theoretically, there's no reason why you shouldn't. They just have a different body than you have. I mean, theoretically, there's no logic to taking care of yourself more than you take care of others. But we all do it. And is there any way to stop that? I mean, is there any way to reach the opposite where you could just care about other people as much as you care about yourself? It would be some kind of liberation, I think. It would be some kind of moksha, you know. I think it would be somehow very great release or somehow great liberation to escape the desire to take care of yourself more than other people. I mean, some kind of illness. And I think we all sense that. And then we're all like wondering how you could do it. You know, how could you pull that off? And that's the subject that we're starting tonight. Okay, so that the benefit or the idea is that by the end of this process, you could care about other people as much as you care about yourself. And if that would be some kind of great, incredible, liberating experience and something very beautiful. And I think you hunger for it. I think you know it. I think you have some hunger for being like that. And it's very frustrating not to be able to do it. You know, it's very frustrating to encounter your own selfishness from time to time. And or just your lack of compassion for people, you know. I think it's very, I don't know about you, but for me it's very depressing, you know. So Shantideva, Master Shantideva, has a plan. You know, he has a strategy. And he has a suggestion about how to get this compassion. And we're going to start that process tonight. So that's the goal. You know, that's the idea. And maybe two or three people in this room, if you haven't got it already, which I don't know, will get it. You know, maybe a couple people get it. But the bottom line is you have to follow the plan. You know, you have to study it. And then you have to put it into practice. You know, you have to try to bring it about. And that part, you know, I can't do. You know, that part I can't. I can repeat what Master Shantideva says is the method. And then I've met people who seem to have accomplished this goal. And then I've met other people who seem that they haven't accomplished it. And maybe they've been studying and doing Dharma for the same amount of time. And then you just wonder about the difference between them. What happened to the one person and what didn't happen to the other person. And it seems, I think it's just doing it. It's just trying it. It's just trying to do it, something like that. And the second kind of person is just not really serious. They don't really want to do it. You know? So we're going to start that strategy, and there are certain steps, and you have to do them. And so, you know, you can learn the Tibetan, and you can learn all the outline, and you can get 100 on your homework, and ace the quiz, but that's not the point. I mean, the point is you have to try it, and you probably won't get another chance. You know, I mean, these classes will go on, or maybe not, or things will happen, but it's safe to say that most likely you won't hear this whole outline again very soon. And you really have to do it now. You have to start tonight. You have to think about it and start doing it. What's that like? If it's hard to see or you can't hear it, just make noise, okay? And if anybody can find us a nice, beautiful, big free place to have classes. We are open to suggestions. Say Gyalkin?
Gyalkin?
Gyalkin? It's good, or maybe it's the room, I don't know. Okay. Say Tunkin.
Tunkin.
Okay. We have to get rid of the Gyalkins, and we have to collect all the Tunkins. Okay. Gyal means something that works against something, and Kin means a condition. So Gyalkin means, I don't know what you want to translate that. I mean, it's like you want to make enchiladas with pepperoni cheese. That's a Gyalkin. You know, it's something that works against what you want to pull off. Okay, it's a factor or a condition which is against what you want to... What do you want to
do? Obstacle.
Okay, I don't know. It's not really an obstacle. There's another word for them. Gel means works against. Contradictory, I don't know. Anyway, you know. You can just put this event in space time. Tunken is the opposite. Tunken means a conducive condition. Okay, a conducive condition. Like, you want to cook a nice meal and they stick you in the cafeteria of the Quaker church, you know. There is key lime. And you know, that's a Tunken. Those are Tunken. We're going to study, we're starting the second chapter of the Vaisabha Charter. The first chapter was the sales pitch. You know, the first chapter was, this is what compassion is like. You can get it if you want. And this is how it would feel. You have some kind of hunger. I mean, you maybe recognize it or you didn't recognize it yet, but you will not be happy until you get bodhicitta. You know, you will not feel contented or full until you get bodhicitta. You need it. You want it. And that's the whole... The first chapter was describing what it feels like when you get it and to love other people as much as you love yourself, basically. And that is totally liberating experience. It's a totally different way to walk through Manhattan, if you have them. So first we have to study Gyalkin. What is it that prevents us from reaching that stage where we care about other people as much as we care about ourselves? You know, what is it that blocks us? Like, there are certain things that block you, and there are other things that you have to get together. There are certain conducive conditions you have to get together. But first you have to study the things that block you. You have what we call spiritual obstacles. You have inner obstacles that you're not even aware of. It's not like a tumor or, you know, inability to digest or something. I mean, it's inside you, and you have it, and it's holding you back, and you don't even know about it, and no one's ever talked to you about it, and even if you believed it, you wouldn't have any clue about how to get rid of it. And that's a Gyalkin. Those are inner obstacles that prevent you from reaching your spiritual goals, and you must study them and learn how to remove them. You must figure out what they are, and then you must remove them. And then, like, half the battle is over. You know, if you could learn how to identify the internal obstacles or blinders that we have, and then if you learn how to eliminate them, then without any trouble at all, you'd have to be halfway to the goal of reaching bodhicitta, of being able to have bodhicitta. So, Master Shantideva describes how, in the opening part of your reading tonight, first you have to get that intention. I mean, I think we all realize how sexy it would be to have compassion. You know, how nice it would be, and how much different it would feel if you really cared about other people as much as you care about yourself. I mean, you understand that. So in a way, you've got munsen. You know, you have the wish. You feel the wish in you. And then you have juksem. Juksem means, you know, you have the intention to do something about it. You're coming to class. You do have those two intentions. They're not real bodhicitta yet, but they're kind of a form of bodhicitta. You have those. Next you have to study the Gyalkins. You have to study what it is inside you that holds you back, that you don't even know about yet. You know, it's inside you, it's been inside you your whole life, and you have to identify it, and then you have to learn how to get rid of it. And that's the whole thing we're going to talk about tonight. The second chapter is the art of Dikpa Shakpa. Say Dikpa?
Shakpa.
Dikpa?
Dikpa.
Shakpa. Dikpa means bad deeds. And as we said, it comes from a Tibetan word that means when you dig somebody, hey, you know, it means wise people would say, ew, bad. Dikpa means bad deeds. Shapa means, Tibetan word meaning to split yourself open. Like just admit it. Just open up your heart and say, I did it. And this is a purification process. We're going to get to that next class. Because even Dikpa Shapa, you have to do three other things first. We are not even good enough to start the purification process. There has to be some mini purification to start some major purification, okay? Or some mini good karma collection. Okay? And there are certain actions that are very good for collecting the necessary good karma to get to the point where you can do a purification. So this is like a bridge to get you to purification. The subject of the second chapter, the name of the second chapter, is how to purify your heart. But there are certain preliminaries that you have to do even before that. You can't do a proper purification without these preliminaries. You must do a proper purification of the Gelkens if you want to get bodhicitta. You will never be able to love other people as much as you love yourself if you can't do the purification. You'll never be able to do the purification if you don't do three other things first. So we're going to study those three tonight.
Yeah. In the homework it said that the wish for enlightenment for bodhicitta destroys your bad deeds. Mm-hmm. And in the reading it wasn't clear to me. Are you saying that just getting bodhicitta destroys negative karma, or do you have to do purification in conjunction with it, or what is that?
There were a lot of questions about that question on the homework, and it wasn't very clear. And I'm sorry, and we won't be too tough on you. Basically, if you ever got to the point where you had real bodhicitta, it would be extremely difficult to collect any bad deeds, and whatever bad deeds you had already done would be short-circuited, or their energy would be lowered. There's a point you reach before you see emptiness directly, called Drolam Sopa, the third stage of the second path. Once you get there, you cannot take birth in the lower realm, period. Impossible. Because certain bad deeds, in fact, that's the first kind of cessation. When you say Buddhist cessation, you get a cessation forever taking birth in the lower realm. You cannot after that point. And that's basically the answer to that question is bodhicitta is so powerful. True bodhicitta. Not thinking about it and not the intention, like some kind of intention. The real emotion, reaching real bodhicitta, which is, we're studying that, we're studying how to get to the real thing, is so powerful that it would destroy your bad deeds. Yeah. There's a technical term called ultimate bodhicitta, which is seeing emptiness directly. It doesn't really have anything to do with bodhicitta. It is the direct perception of emptiness. And that is the real antidote to bad deeds. But that's another story.
Krishna Michael, does bodhicitta then prevent the negative karma from flowering, or does it destroy them?
They say both. Prevents the old one from... They say burns it up.
So without the four appointed powers?
By doing the four appointed powers.
So you have to have those.
Yeah. Okay. First one. We're going to go through three activities, which are for what? Just to get you to the point where you can do purification. Purification is the real expelling of the Gelkin. These are just to get that far. These are preliminaries to getting rid of your Gelkin. It's like creating some positive energy so that you can get rid of your Gelkin. We're going to have a patience meditation. We're going to shrink this room smaller and smaller and make it more and more lousy. And then we're going to reach the fourth chapter. This is chapter 6. Say Chaktawa. Chaktawa.
Chaktawa.
Chaktawa means prostrating or bowing down. Prostration. Chak means hand. It's the honorific word for hand. This is a chak. I mean, you talk about the Dalai Lama's chak. And you call your own hand a lapa. So it's the honorific word for hand. Sawa means to look for something. Those of you who were in Philadelphia this weekend, we spent 20 something bucks in Sawa Sena Manye. Sawa means to look for something. Okay. So what does it mean to look for the hand? It means the Lama has something in his or her hand, and when you do a prostration, you're asking them to grant you that. And that's the etymology of the Tibetan translation to Chakshawa. It's not my intention, and the main thrust of the reading for this class is not to go into Chakshawa, you know. But I'll just say a few words about it. You have to do it. Okay. I'll tell you my experience with Chakshawa. I went to India to study Buddhism. I looked all over for Buddhists. They told me, you're 1,000 years too late. And I was very depressed. I went to an Indian ashram and meditated, and I was like... And then finally I bumped into a Tibetan monk and, you know, changed my life. But anyway, I remember, they said, go to Dharamsala, you know, you can study there, they speak English. And I went to Dharamsala, and I remember being on the bus. I remember the bus stopping at a rest stop. I remember getting out. I remember standing and looking at the mountains of India. You know, and I remember thinking, you know, I'm going to get to this class. Everyone else is going to know what's going on except me. And I'm going to feel really stupid. I don't know what I'm doing, you know. And I remember that the bus got into Dharamsala. I went up, you know, tried to find a place to sleep. The next day I go to Buddhism class, you know, and there's this class like this. And there's a really great Lama there and some great translators, Tibetan monks. And then everybody gets up and starts doing this thing. And I said, yeah, see? They all know what they're doing, and I don't know what they're doing, you know. And they're all prostrating, you know. And, like, I grew up a very good Christian, and I was a good Christian, and I, you know, I did all that stuff. And it was very good. I mean, I had a very fine time. There was this commandment about not bowing down to graven images, and I was like, I'd waited my whole life to see, to get a chance not to do it, you know. Because I didn't know, you know, I'm waiting for the devil to show some pictures and say, get down, you know. These guys had red robes, and it just, the whole thing seemed like, yeah, but here it is, you know. They're asking me to get down on the ground, and I refused. And I refused for weeks, you know. I couldn't get into it. It just seemed really wrong to be bowing down, especially to a person. You know, and it just didn't seem right to me, and to get down on the ground. And I wasn't going to go along with just what everybody else was doing if I didn't think it was right. You know, if I didn't understand it, I wasn't going to do it. Because I went through that, you know. So I didn't do it. And then, I think you have to talk about frustration. Frustration, you can think it's some Asian custom. You know, I've heard this story too. You know, people say, oh, you know, that's just an Asian thing. We don't have to do that. You know, that's just something they do in, you know, east of the Euphrates, you know, whatever. You know, that's just something people do there. You know, you don't have that kind of eyes. You don't have to do that, you know. You don't have to get down and do that. That's just an Asian thing, you know. And you can think that. I mean, I thought it for a long time. But I'll tell you, and I tell you the whole story of frustration in one sentence, you know. Few sentences. And that's all I have to say about frustration, really. Is that on the day that you see emptiness directly, you know, on the day that happens to you, you meet the Dharmakaya. I mean, that is the body of the Buddha. You perceive directly the body of the Buddha. And the immediate, as you come down out of it, the immediate reaction is to get down on the floor with your face down on the floor, period. You know, and that's real frustration. I mean, that's the source of all frustration. The real thing that's happening in frustration is that a presence is before you with which you must get down with your face in the dirt. Period. And it's the most natural thing in the world. You couldn't imagine, there's no hesitation, there's no thought, how do I look, you know. There's no thought about anything. The most natural reaction, and it will happen, is that you get down and get your face in the ground, and you do not look up. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that you can see the Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya you saw 2 minutes before, when you're in the direct procession emptiness. But when you come out and then you realize what happened, the natural reaction is to get down, face down on the floor. You know, and I can't say more about it. You know, if a Buddha or some similar being walked into this room, And if you really understood who they were, which we probably wouldn't, which you're probably not capable of, you would just get down in the dirt. You'd get your face down in the dirt. And you would wait until they said, get up or something, you know. And that's a real frustration. If ever you met one of those beings, which we don't have the kawa, you know, we don't have the goodness to meet a being like that, that we are aware of. But if it ever happens to you that you meet one of these beings, there's no other reaction possible. You just get down and you put your face in the floor and you wait. And that's a real prostration. Now, what are we doing? You know, what do we do when we do prostration? I mean, what I'm saying is try to get that frame of mind in your mind. Okay? I mean, in the monastery, if you sneak out and see a movie and they catch you, the Gitu, the debate master, you know, he's also the disciplinarian. So he'll get up in the middle of, you know, it's 1,200 monks there. He'll say, you know, Jampa so-and-so has been identified. He went to a movie, stuck out to a movie last night in Zelikopi, you know. And Jampa come up here, and they have to come up, and they have to hold a movie poster up like that for like an hour, you know. And then they have to do like 100,000 prostrations or something. And I remember the geek was always screaming at them and saying, you know, don't waste the time. You know, like you're going to have to do some prostrations now. And don't waste the time. You know, meaning, prostration is a wonderful opportunity to waste your time. You know, I know myself that when I do prostration, I'm just normally thinking about something, almost always thinking about something else. You know, I'm not thinking, I'm in the presence of the Dharmakaya, and I must get my face on the floor. You know, I never think like that. I'm just thinking, oh yeah, it's going to start class, and I wonder what page he's on, and you know, I mean, it rarely comes into my thought that I'm bowing down to the Dhammakaya or something like that. It just doesn't come into my mind. And then when you do that, you've wasted a good opportunity, and it will not act in the way it's supposed to act. And then, you know, 10 years later, you'll be one of these pitiful, middle-aged Dharma students who didn't get it, you know, and they're like, gee, I do all my things every morning, nothing's happening, you know, I'm not very happy, I'm sort of, you know, tired, getting older, and nothing's happening, you know, I nothing's happening in my life, I don't feel much happier than I did 10 years ago, you know, I know some more Tibetan words or something, you know, or something like that, but it's a failure, it's a real failure, and it comes from failing to use the time when you're doing things like prostration. It comes from wasting the time. Prostration is a sacred, it's a chance to do something totally different than going to work. You know, it's a chance to do something completely sacred. You know, it's a chance to assert your spiritual life. Right there. You know, you get like 1 minute to do something which everyone thinks is crazy. You know, you get to do one thing that you're not getting paid for, and you're not, you know, getting, it's not any kind of social pressure to do it, especially for Buddhists in America, and it's one opportunity in your life to say, I'm following a spiritual path, you know, and I want to reach those goals, you know, it's like some opportunity to do something which is not commercial, and which doesn't have any connection to your worldly life. It's crazy to prosper. It has no function. It doesn't produce any wealth, you know, it doesn't, nobody will pay you, nobody will admire you much. You know, there's no, especially if you're doing it alone, there's just no possible non-spiritual motivation, you know, it's just, it's a chance to state, I'm on a spiritual path, you know, and it's a chance to make a gesture, and this is very important, in which you are saying, I believe that the Dharmakaya exists, and I believe that the Dharmakaya is in this room. Yeah. And you're stating that when you do a prostration. So I believe the Buddha is here. You know, it's like a statement that I believe the Buddha exists. You know, and I want to reach that thing. And that's a statement. And prostration is that. And the day that you see emptiness directly, you'll just get down on the floor. You'll be down on the floor. Charlton Heston in the Ten Commandments when he meets the burning bush. If you ever get a chance, check it out, you know. He's like, down on these rocks. No, it's really like that. It really is like that. They did it pretty good. He doesn't get all the way down. He should get all the way down, okay? He's like a foot off the ground or something. But like that, it really is like that. So it's a chance. I'm not seeing the mechanics, but that's not the point. The point is, don't waste the time. If you do waste the time, you will never get to Bodhicitta. You know, and you'll be one of those very sad people who tried and didn't do it. You know? So, I mean, the Buddhist is supposed to not... These are all supposed to, okay? When you do your Tamil Dharma, when you bring your hands to your chest, you're supposed to put the thumbs inside, okay? This is said to be not a Buddhist gesture, okay? Although you see it in some Buddhist countries. So we're talking Tibetan custom or whatever, Indian Buddhist custom. Okay? You put your thumbs inside. Okay. And then you put it once up here, okay? This is supposed to be a cause for the part of the physical body of a Buddha later. Okay? Like a Buddha has a special, in the 8th chapter of the Abhisamvikara, the whole chapter, the Buddha has a special way that he or she looks in what we call the classic Nirmanakaya, in the classic Buddha form. Okay? Why do I say classic? I mean, don't discount, we say Kurdepa, you know, don't put down the Buddha. Don't be stupid, you know. I mean, they don't have to look like bumpy head, long ears, you know, thing over here. They don't have to look like that. That's called Chokichuku, which means the classic Nirmanakaya. But they have zillions of other forms they can appear in. And they don't have to have, you know, Asian face. They could be anything. They could be anybody. They could be a tree. They could be a chair, they could be a dog, they could be the person sitting next to you. What's the problem? You know, why not? I had an opportunity in the Hermitage in Russia to see the wall painting from Khotan, you know, and this is before Buddhism entered Tibet. And all the Buddhas, like Vajrapani, he looks like Kalinka, you know, he looks Western. You know, they all look like Americans, actually. Seriously, you know, this is before Buddhism went to China and Tibet, and they all look like nice, normal Greek guys, you know. And what I'm trying to say is, there's no Nirmanakaya can show any way it wants, no problem, no problem like that. Okay, but anyway, if you want to get the Chokichoku, the classic Nirmanakaya, you have to do this, okay? The first one is up here, okay, at the top of your head. There's also some significance in the secret teaching, which are secret. Okay, then you put it here. Okay, this is called min thumb. This right here is called min thumb. That's your min thumb. And then later, it acts as a cross for the sutu of the Buddha, which is a special mark of the Buddha. And then once at the throat, which means like the mouth there, okay? Which means that someday you'll be able to speak like a Buddha and say the things that a Buddha said. And then once at your heart, which means you'll gain the mind of a Buddha. You'll learn to think like a Buddha. And those are it's four points like that. Then the custom is that you get down slowly. Okay, and that has a symbolic meaning. You're like saying, I do not want to go to the lower realm. Okay, if you are in Philadelphia this weekend, we discussed the possibility of going to lower realm, which, since it's only a shift in your mind, is a lot easier than like getting on a bus and going to the lower realm. You know, in other words, you could be in the lower realm 30 seconds from now, no problem. If lower realms were self-existent, if they didn't have emptiness, it'd be kind of hard to get there. Since they are empty, and since they are projections, basically, you can get there in about 30 seconds. There's no guarantee that one of us in this room won't be in the lower realm in 30 seconds. Okay? And so you get down slow. It's a statement. I don't want to be there. Okay? And you get down slow. When you reach the ground, your palm should be flat and not, you should not have the thumbs inside. Then the palms are flat on the ground. The custom is that you touch your two knees you touch your two hands, two palms, and you touch your forehead on the floor. That's a symbol of called a short chak, a short prostration. Yang chak is your whole body out, okay? And on the day that you see the Dhammakaya, it'll be, trust me, you know, whole body out, face down, you know, you'll be rubbing your face in the floor. Really, natural reaction to meeting one of those beings. And then on that day you'll understand prostration. But in the meantime, try to visualize certain objects in front of you. Okay, what are the objects? I'm going to go over that quickly, then we'll take a break. Yeah. Yeah, I think I've seen that. It seems to be a good custom. I don't know. I don't know much about it. I believe that's a custom. Say, coin chop? So those of you who know Tibetan, it's not kun. It looks like kun, right? And it's just one of those words that have a different pronunciation. Okay, coin chop? Koin means very rare, very hard to find. Chok means highest or supreme, highest one. Sum means the number three. This is the three jewels. Okay, in Sanskrit, three ratna. Okay, koin chok, supreme, hard to find. Was the early Tibetan translation for jewel, because they're three jewels. And this is the most important objects of your prostration. Okay? And this is going to be true of offering, which we're going to cover, and also it's true of going for refuge. We are covering the object, the ultimate object of all three preliminary activities. Before you get to purification, you have to do three activities. All of them are aimed at koin chok sum. And that's Buddha Dharma Sangha. Okay. Say Sangye. Koin chok. Sangye. Koin chok. Sangye means Buddha. Koin chok means jewel. And we're going to talk about, there's a slight difference between Buddha and Buddha jewel. Okay, they're not exactly the same thing. Buddha and Buddha jewel are not exactly the same thing. We're going to talk about Buddha jewel. What is Buddha jewel? Like when you do prostration, who are you doing prostration to? When you make offerings, who are you doing offerings to? When you go for refuge, who are you going to refuge to? We're going to cover that. Okay, Sangye Koin Chok. There's two kinds of Sangye Koin Chok. One is called the one that's not real, and the other one's called the one which is real. Okay? Kuntak and Dindam. So-called Buddha jewel and the real Buddha jewel. The so-called Buddha jewel is those pictures and statues that are sitting on those altars. Okay? That's the so-called Buddha jewel. It's not the real Buddha jewel. Okay? I mean, we don't prostrate that way, we prostrate this way. Why? Because there's more Buddhas over here than over there? You know? No, there's a picture of a Buddha over here. You know, there's just a representation of a Buddha over here. Another thing that happens to you on the day that you see emptiness directly. When you come down, and when you are looking around the temple and you see a tanka, a picture of a Buddha, you're seeing someone that you saw. You see what I mean? It's not a picture anymore. It's a photograph. You know? You're looking at something. You did not see that particular Nirmanakaya. That's not the point. But you met the Dharmakaya. You saw the Dharmakaya directly. You met the essence of the Buddha. And, here's a picture of what I saw. You know, here's the outer expression of what I saw. And so your relationship to those pictures takes on a totally different face. Totally, absolutely, completely different. They're not pictures anymore. You know, you look at it and you say, somebody saw what I saw. And they taught somebody to paint it. And then somebody taught somebody else, and somebody taught somebody else, and somebody else. And then here's this painting here. You know, and it's some kind of, your relationship with these pictures changes. You're looking at a picture of someone you know. And it's totally different, absolutely different, and your whole relationship to the pictures changes. So we prostrate to pictures, but they are not the Buddha jewel. What is the Buddha jewel? The main Buddha jewel is the Dhammakaya. Okay? The main thing in which you are taking refuge, the main thing to which you are prostrating, the main thing to which you make offerings, is the Buddha jewel. It's the Dhammakaya. Dhammakaya, roughly, is the emptiness of the other three bodies in the Buddha. And we'll talk about it sometime. Basically, the emptiness of the Buddha. Dhammakaya is basically the emptiness of the Buddha. The main point here, the main refuge, the main object which is worthy of getting your offerings, the main thing which is worthy of being prostrated to, and the thing to which you will get your face down in the ground when you see it, is Dhammakaya. It's the Dharma body of the Buddha, which is the emptiness of the Buddha. And you have to study it. That's the real Buddha. That's the real Buddha jewel. And then, about 1 millisecond after you achieve it, a Dhammakaya, Dharma body, you are able to send out all these pictures of yourself. You know, hey, I'd like to look like Helen McHale tonight. Send out Helen McHale in Manhattan, you know. Something like that. I mean, after that you have a choice to look like anything. But at the first instant of enlightenment, you become the Dhammakaya. And actually you achieve also the ultimate, the Sambhogakaya. We won't get into that. Basically, your physical form could be anything. The main essence of you is your emptiness. And that's what you're prostrating to, that's what you're making offerings to, and we'll talk about it. Now, what's the point of doing that? Should I open up my closet and prostrate to that emptiness in there? Or my wallet, or something like that, you know what I mean? Does it have to be that particular emptiness, or, you know, what's the point? What's the benefit of that? What's the benefit of prostrating to something that seems like it doesn't even exist, you know? Yeah, we have to study that. But that's the essence of the first jewel. Say, chu, coin chop. Chu, coin chop. Chu means Dharma. Chu means Dharma. And coin chop means jewel. So this is the Dharma jewel. Not the same as the Dharma. The Dharma basically, it has many different meanings. One meaning is the teachings. One meaning is any existing thing. And then as the jewel of the Dharma is something different. The jewel of the Dharma is the one that you're prospering to. The jewel of the Dharma is the one that you're making offerings to. The jewel of the Dharma is the one you're taking refuge in. If you do it well, you'll be ready to purify yourself. If you don't do it well, you won't be ready. If you do it well, you'll get a kind of love which is as great as the love for others that you have for yourself. If you don't do it well, you'll end up just the same as you are now. Probably worse. I mean, people tend to degenerate as they go through life spiritually. You gotta do it. You know, or you can do it half-assed and you'll get a half-assed result and you'll be a half-assed spiritual person and you'll die. And you'll go to some half-assed place. Seriously, I'm deadly serious. I mean, we will die. We'll all be a bunch of corpses, and a few people will go to some sweet things. And the rest of us will say, you know, well, what did I do wrong? You know? And this is what you did wrong. Okay? You have to know what you're bowing down to. And it's Chukorja. Okay? Dharma jewel. What is the Dharma jewel? The Dharma jewel, which is not really the Dharma jewel, okay, Kundan, is the book. You know, all those nice books. And the teachings themselves, you know, the verbal teachings in this. His Holiness gives a lecture. That's not the real Dharma jewel. It's Buddhist Dharma. It's not the Dharma jewel. What is the Dharma jewel? Two things, okay? Realizations. For example, those five paths that we talked about last week are all real Dharma. The real Dharma jewel. And seeing emptiness directly is the ultimate Dharma jewel, the real Dharma jewel. When you bow down and get your face in the floor, you're bowing down to the perception of emptiness, the direct perception of emptiness. When you make offerings, you're making offerings to the direct perception of emptiness. When you go for refuge, you're going to refuge to the direct perception of emptiness. We'll talk about it. Cessations, I'll give you two examples. Once you reach, as I said, a certain point in your understanding of emptiness,
which is at the third level, sopa, at the second path, jorlam, you can never take birth in the lower realms again. Totally impossible. Can't do it. That's called a cessation. Meaning, you just can't do it anymore. Something won't happen anymore. Never, ever. Okay. When you see emptiness directly and come down out of it, two things won't happen ever again. You will never doubt Buddhism again. Totally, perfectly, purely, impossible to doubt Buddhism again. Never will happen. It doesn't matter if someone could shoot you, burn you, threaten you, try to talk you out of it. Doesn't matter. You saw emptiness directly, you know the Buddha exists, you saw your future lives directly. Tell me anything. I mean, tell that person anything. They saw their future lives. They saw the day that they're going to become a Buddha. So what are you going to tell them? It's like somebody knows all the lottery numbers like 3 days in advance. Seriously. So what are you going to tell them? You know, are you going to give them a money-making scheme? You know, who wants to hear it? They have no reason to listen to anybody. Period. They fuck. You can't talk them out of it. You get a cessation for the emotion of doubt. That's an example of cessation. Those two things, for example, seeing emptiness directly, and for example, never doubting again, because you saw directly yourself. Those are the Dharma jewel. When you bow down, when you put water bowls out in the morning, these are the things to whom you're presenting them. Okay. Can the absence of doubt in your mind drink water? It's like putting out cookies for Santa Claus, who's not even a person. You know what I mean? Can they drink the water? It's not even them. I mean, can the absence of doubt in your mind drink water? Okay. Can the direct perception of emptiness drink water? Eat cookies on top, you know? Lose school points, you know? And can the Dharmakaya, which is the sheer emptiness of a Buddha's other three bodies, can it drink water? It can't. It's a permanent thing. It's an unchanging thing. Can't change from not drinking to drinking. It's unchanging. Totally unchanging. Cannot drink water. Cannot be aware of your offering water. Okay. Can a lack of doubt in your mind be aware that you've offered water today? No. Okay. You're making offerings. Say, Gendun?
Gendun.
Quanchou. Gendun means Sangha. Okay? Sangha. In Sanskrit, Sangha. Jewel. The Sangha jewel, which is not the Sangha jewel, Kunta, is all those dudes and dudesses running around in red robes. Okay? People in red robes are, you know, fully, people who have taken one of the eight Pratimoksha vows. I'm sorry. One of the five higher Pratimoksha vows. Okay. Are called nominal Sangha jewel. So-called Sangha jewel. Right? The real Sangha jewel, to which you prostrate, to which you make offerings, and to which you take refuge, is anyone who has seen emptiness directly. That's a pakpa, that's an arya, that's a gendin koinsha. On the day that you see emptiness directly, you become two of the three jewels. You can open a store called Three Jewels. And you can sit there. Okay? Because you are now worthy of the substation and offering and refuge of the entire world. Okay? You can sit there in a chair. Because when people make offerings, when people take refuge, and people prostrate, their prosperity is you. You are two of the three jewels. You are the what people are seeking protection in. They are looking to you for help. It's very interesting. Because at that moment, you become two of them. I mean, you have the Dharma jewel in your mind, and you are the Sangha jewel at that moment. We're going to take a break there. Try to come back in 10 minutes and we might finish remotely on time. So I think we will finish on time. Probably. Okay. This is taking refuge, going for refuge. Mm-hmm. And you take refuge in the three jewels. And speaking of the three jewels.
That was smooth.
That's what we are learning today. Anyway, I'm here today to make a short announcement. Okay, I'm here today to make a short announcement.
Everybody talks about Buddhist refuge, you know, and this is another one of those things that I was told, you know, in Dharamsala, you gotta take refuge, you know, and you'll get a name, you know, and so that's about it, you know, I have to take refuge and I'll get a name. Who do I take refuge? The Buddha Dharma Sangha. Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharma Sangha. Yeah, you learn this little thing and you get a name. And it's like, okay, but what does it mean? And I think it's very possible that we never learn what refuge means. You know, it's supposed to be the thing that differentiates the Buddhist from a person who's not a Buddhist. If you take refuge, you know you're a Buddhist. If you don't take refuge, you're not a Buddhist. Okay, there's a joke in the monastery that there was an abbot of a major monastery up on a throne teaching thousands of monks, and he was not a Buddhist because he didn't have refuge. He didn't take refuge. So you have to know what refuge is, okay? And it's one of the three preliminaries before you can do purification. Okay? If you don't take refuge correctly, if you don't know what refuge is, the worst thing is you won't get it. And refuge means protection, so you won't get any protection. What do you take refuge in? The three jewels. Those three jewels that we talked about. The trick question is, how can they protect you? And we talked about it in Philadelphia the other night. Buddha, his other name is Shakyamuni, right? Lord of the Shakya. Not to be confused with Sakya. The Sakyas are Tibetan Buddha. Shakyas were the tribe of which the Buddha was the head. He was the head of the whole Shakya tribe. And there was a point when his village was attacked, and all the Shakyas were attacked by these people. People ran into the Buddha, and ran into the Buddha's house and actually physically hid behind him and touched him and grabbed him and said, protect me. And then soldiers came in and chopped him down with swords. You know, standing next to a fully enlightened being, holding on to the fully enlightened being's robes in his house, seeking protection, they were cut down and murdered. Right next to him. Okay? And so what's protection? You know, see, I mean, you have to get that in mind. If you came from the same background I came from, this kind of a Judeo-Christian thing, there's a thing called God, He likes you, He'll take care of you. You know, seriously, I'm not making fun of it or I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying, we come from that background. We believe subconsciously, in the gut, that there's this thing, and if you want it bad enough, they'll take care of you. So what's the sense of having somebody to take care of you when you can stand next to him and get murdered, you know, and he can't help you? What's the point? You know, what does refuge mean? And that's the whole point. You know, when you take refuge, we're on to the second, we finished prostration, right? But basically it's all to the same beings, or the same what, I don't know. I mean, the Dharmakaya is not a being. The Dharmakaya is the absence of a self-existent thing that never existed in the first place. Okay? And the Dharma jewel is some thought in some guy's mind, and the Sangha jewel is some guy who's seen something that we maybe haven't. You know, so how are they going to help you? You know, what's the point? What's refuge mean? It's supposed to be the most central, basic, important Buddhist concept. What does it mean? How can they protect you? And you have to study it. It takes a long time. In the monastery, it's like we do a 12-year course in Abhisamalankara. It's one of the first subjects. So the basic thing is this. You can't really get protection until you understand emptiness. Period. Okay? Buddhism will not help you much. I mean, you will not have any assured protection until you can understand emptiness pretty well. Yeah. If you see it directly, you're cool. Absolutely cool. I mean, on your way out, you know how many lifetimes, you've seen your future lives, you've seen your own enlightenment, you know all of these things directly. And you will never have a bad time in any life, major, again, period. And you know it. So what's that feel like? What's it feel like to know your rent's always going to be paid? You know, you know, what's that feel? That's rejection. You know, what's it feel like to know you will never die and go somewhere strange? Never, ever. You know, it just won't happen. And you see it. You know, and to know that you will be this eternally compassionate, perfect being in a certain amount of time. And you know it. That's protection. That's real protection. And you have to try to get that protection. That's real protection. And that's why all these three jewels are linked up with what? There's one word that keeps happening in all the three jewels. Emptiness. In Dharmakaya the Buddha, emptiness. Dharma jewel, seeing emptiness directly. And what happens to you after it. And in Sangha jewel, becoming a person who's seeing emptiness directly. This is the real protection. Okay? That picture cannot help you. Trust me. Come up here. Let me drill your teeth. We'll ask him, you know. I mean, image of a Buddha, you know, some statue cannot protect you. Can. The Buddha himself cannot protect you. You know, so you have to, it's the understanding Dharma that protects you. And that is the refuge. That is taking refuge. You have to have that. Otherwise, these pictures won't help you. You know, people have been slaughtered next to the pictures. You know, people have died on altars. You know, it's not protection. You have to understand Dharma. You have to understand karma, for example. And that's protection. Understanding karma is great protection. Okay, and those are all kinds of taking refuge. So you have to study refuge. You have to learn about refuge. Mainly, when you bow down in the future, you have to be thinking about emptiness. And you have to be thinking about people who have seen it directly. If there was one person in this world who had seen emptiness directly, I'm bowing down to that person right now. And if you're not thinking that, you're not doing frustration. You're not doing it. You're just not doing it. It's not some picture on a table. It's a being who has seen emptiness directly, or a being who has reached enlightenment. Basically, those two things. Master Shantideva throws in Bodhisattva, okay? That's okay. We'll turn Bodhisattva. Okay? Those are the objects of you. When you bow down, when you do prostration, you must think of that. You must think of those three jewels. The real meaning of the three jewels. Okay? And then you have to take refuge in the sense of, okay, respect the pictures, respect the statues. Bow down to them because they represent those things. Respect Sangha, you know. Sangha, we are, you know, especially Rambi Sangha, the plain old people, and you know that. But you must respect the robe. You know, it doesn't matter who the robe is on. It really doesn't matter at all. You must respect the robe. The Buddha said, this is my representative in the world. You know, people who have those vows, who wear those robes, and you have to imagine that they are representing the Buddha. And it's not at all the point to think of their personal failings or what's wrong with them personally, and then not respect the robes. You must respect the robes at all costs. You know, you must. And that's taking refuge in the nominal karma. Okay? And you must respect the books, and you must care for the books. Take care of them. And that's a reflection that you are really going for refuge in emptiness, in the understanding of emptiness, and compassion. Those are all symbolic actions that you're doing to show that you know what's going on. We are representing people who have seen emptiness directly. And that's taking refuge. Okay, third thing, we have 4 minutes to cover the entire homework. Say chepa.
Chepa.
Chepa. Chepa means making offerings. Okay, making offerings. Again, it's a statement, okay? Making offerings, I think a lot of American Buddhists, me included, I mean, I like the philosophy, I like the meditation, I like thinking. I'm not particularly into, you know, going out, buying a cake, taking it and putting it on some table in front of a picture. You know, I mean, it just doesn't, I don't get that urge, you know. It's not something that I'm driven to do, like I'm driven to study or meditate or something like that. Like I'm not, it just doesn't do it. In the way that the other things do it. But you have, that's because you don't understand offering. You have to make offerings. You will not reach the state we're talking about. You won't see emptiness directly. You won't develop that love for others that is greater than or equal to the love for yourself. You'll never do it unless you make offerings. You must make offerings. You have to learn the art of making offerings, and then you have to make offerings. And if it's some kind of obligation, like prostrating is an obligation, or meditating in the morning is an obligation, Che Mare in Tibetan. They say, the Giku, you know, the debate master says, you know, stupid head, prostrating is not an obligation, it's an honor. It's some kind of thing that geniuses do, you know, they make offerings. And you have to understand what's going on when you make an offering. So we're going to talk about offerings for the next 3 minutes. First of all, it's an action which is totally useless. Okay? Nobody cares if you make offerings. I mean, we don't live in a Buddhist country. So people are not going to say, oh, Tasha, you should see what Tasha put out yesterday. Man, she got moolah. You know, that's really impressive that she would spend all that money. I mean, if you go to Thailand, you see, you know, people competing to who can make the biggest offering or something like that. You know? So nobody's going to do it in this country. Nobody cares. Okay? What I mean is the selfless act. It should be totally, purely uninterested. I mean, do not buy the kind of rolls that you like to eat 2 days later after you take them off the altar. Okay? You destroy the power of the offering. Seriously. If you want to destroy the power of the offering, if you want to make sure the offering is totally wasted, then turn it into something worthless. You know, buy something that you want to eat. Or think about how it's going to look to other people. You know, and you'll just destroy it. It won't be an act of offering. It'll be some worldly thing. A pure act of offering should be unknown. I mean, ideally, people wouldn't even know about it. I mean, go sell your car, buy a diamond, take it to the temple and put it in some corner of the altar where nobody will ever find it. Or throw it in the ocean. Or something like that. That's an offering. That's a real offering. And it should be something meaningful. You know, it should be something, give it your best, you know. Because what you're doing when you make an offering is you're stating that these beings exist. You know, you are making a statement that I believe there's something beyond this world. Now, everything else you do is worldly. You get up, put on your clothes, brush your teeth, comb your hair, eat your breakfast, go to work, walk home, watch TV, read the newspapers, do the magazines, you know, eat, sleep. The whole day is spent wasted. I mean, the whole day is something worldly. And it's just, it'll only cause one thing. It's called death. You know? I mean, it's only an activity which will lead to one thing only. It's death. You know, there's no other result of that activity. It's just wasted time. You know, you want to make it something, offering should be something that's not like that. You know, no one's going to eat it. No one's going to see it. The lack of self-existence in the Buddha's three bodies does not need your case. The direct perception of emptiness cannot eat your cake. Okay? And those beings who have seen emptiness directly aren't in the room. And they can't eat it either. Okay? Like when you offer, I mean, you tend to offer things that are worldly objects, but you have to imagine how that being is taking that thing. They do get something. They suck something out of it. If something happens. It does make contact with those beings. When you put a flower on your altar, they see it. They experience it. Now what happens to them? You know, yeah. We'll talk about it. Okay. How do they experience it? They experience it exactly the same as they experienced their thumbnail, as they experienced the tip of their shoes, as they experience, you know, Pluto, or whatever. For them, it's all the same. They experience it as total bliss. And you can't offer them anything that they don't experience as total bliss. And if you didn't offer anything, they'd still experience that as total bliss. You know, that's the way they are. That's all they know. That's all they're capable of experiencing. So what's the point of offering something to somebody who's not even a person, who can't ever experience it in any way different than if you didn't offer it? They don't need your cake. You are you are working out the purification. You're trying to set up your purification. You're trying to make yourself ready to try to get compassion. And if you don't do it, you won't. And so it's all just for you, really. And when you read Master Shantideva's verses, you'll see. He says he's begging the three jewels to accept his offering for him. Please help me out. Please, could you take my cake? Please? You know, like he's begging the three jewels to take his cake. You know, and they will, and they can. And but the main thing that happens is something changes inside of you. You know, when you make offerings, something changes inside of you. If you want to be a Dharma idiot, you know, if you want to be dharmically retarded, then don't make offerings. You know, just put that in the category of devotional, peripheral stuff that Tibetans do because their mother and father did it. You know, if you want to stay where you are, then don't make offerings. Because making an offering requires spiritual genius. You have to have a high spiritual IQ to make an offering. You know, to want to make an offering, and to understand why you should make an offering, and then to do it, to actually go out and spend good money on something that's going to rot on this table in your room, you know, is an act of genius. And as you get better at it, you will go out and you will spend everything you have. And you'll know why you're doing it. You have to think of it like that. If it feels like an obligation, or prostrating feels like a pain in the butt, you know, it's just some stupid custom that Buddhists do before they have a teaching or something, then you didn't get it at all. And you will not purify, and you will never find those things. And you'll be one of those, you'll either quit, or you'll be one of those boring and bored Dharma students 10 years later who didn't get it, you know, and you have to make offerings. You have to study it and make nice, sweet offerings, okay? And you'll start to get the result. Something will change in you. So do it, okay? Once you do offer, very briefly.
Just a quick question. If everything is a blissful experience and you're perceiving, you know, you're understanding what you're offering is empty, why does it matter if you offer more and more expensive things all the time?
It's just an act of giving everything you have. It's very important. It's like saying that I choose not to be in this mortal world. I will not just go die quiet. Was it go quietly to that, you know, not stake or whatever. No, I'm not going to do that. You know, I'm going to be different, you know. I'm not just going to die like a sheep. I'm going to use the resources I have on something that has real meaning. Instead of a house or a car or a wife or a family or stuff, I'm going to use it for something that has meaning. You know, I'm going to use it for offering. It's going to sit there on the altar and rot. You know, or I'll throw it in the ocean. You know, and then you've really used your money meaningfully. Okay, because you've stated, I believe in the three jewels, and I want to get that. And that's a statement of that. You know, and that's powerful. That's very powerful. You have to do that. Okay, three kinds of offerings. First one we call the offering of things that nobody owns. Okay? The offering of things that nobody owns. By the way, I don't mean to put down family life and all that and things like that. That's not the point. What I'm trying to say is that offer your family something meaningful. You know, if you love your family and your kids and your husband or whatever, offer them enlightenment. Because to offer them food or a place to stay or a new car to drive in, those will all die. They'll all go away. And then the effort is wasted. And that the energy of that money is wasted. You know, try to do something that will get them out of dying. You know, try to give them a real gift. It doesn't mean that you can't offer people smaller gifts, you have to. But what I'm saying is that if you really care for someone, give them something that's more lasting than a car, or a house, or clothes. You know, give them something that will keep them like for a zillion years or so. And you can, and you have the capacity to learn to do that. Now, I'm just saying, use your energy for that, and use your resources for that. Say, doctor. Masume. Zay. Doctor. Masume. Zay. This is the kind of offering you do when you imagine things that have no owners. Okay? Mountains, oceans, flowers, the sky. Just anything you can imagine. There's a list in Shantideva. You're going to get it. Master Shantideva is reading. You're going to get a whole list. Okay, but basically, all those things in the world which nobody claims, okay, you can offer them. Walk through Manhattan, offer them the sunset. You know, offer the sunset to your lama. You know, offer the stars to the three jewels. Very inexpensive. Master Shantideva gets into, why would anybody want to make this offering? He says, well, I didn't have much virtue in my past life. I don't have much money. You know, I really don't have much available cash. I'm like, can I just offer you the stars and the moon and, you know, things like that? And they say, fine. That they would love to have that. Okay? I mean, I used to go out and surfing and sit on the surfboard and offer Geshe Dagi the ocean and the sunset and all that. Fine. No problem. You know, offer it. Offer all those beautiful things. You know, think of beautiful things. When you see a beautiful thing, you know, offer it. Offer it to you. It's very, very sweet. Once you get into it, it's very, very cool. It's very easy. You're walking down the street in Manhattan. You see a particularly beautiful cloud with a red hue on it. And you just offer it to your lama. You know, just, you know, like just for a second, close your eyes. Think of that they can see what you just saw and offer to them. And it will change your inner being. And certain things will start to change. And you'll start to get ready for bodhisattva. And if you don't do it, it won't happen. It's fun, and it's extremely important to do it. So just do it. Then Master Shantideva says, hey, wait, there is something I owe. Even us credit card bankrupted people. Say, Rangi.
Rangi.
Lu.
Ulwa.
Rangi.
Rangi.
Lu. Ulwa.
Ulwa.
Rangi Lu means your own body. Okay? Nobody in here doesn't own their own body. Unless slavery has been reintroduced, I don't know. Okay? Rangi Lu means your own body. Ulwa means to offer. Offer your own body. There is a story of the Bodhisattva who's called crying all the time. Saksungra. He heard this voice in his head. It said, go east, young man. Don't go west. Don't go south. Don't go north. I think it was east. And don't do anything else. Just go. And he just dropped everything and went. And he just started walking to the east, you know. And he keeps hearing this voice. Go. Go, 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 go. And he's walking. And then he starts to see this lama. This is in ancient India. And he starts to see this lama teaching. And he keeps walking and walking and walking, getting closer and closer. And he starts to hear the lama, he's teaching emptiness. This is the 8,000 verses Prajnaparamita, a very famous scripture. And he's hearing it, he's hearing this lama, he's getting closer and closer. He starts to see the lama and all his students sitting in his room, teaching, and he's like entranced, you know. He can't believe it. He's walking, walking, walking. Finally gets to this town. And he says, I got to buy some offerings for my lama. He figured out that he's in this such and such a house. And so he stops in the marketplace to pick up some offerings. And he realizes he's totally broke. He has no money at all. So he's looking around for something that he could sell. And he decides to sell his arms and his legs. You know, as meat. Like, he just decides that if anyone wants, like, a hamburger, you know, he will offer some fat part of his arm or some fat part of his leg or something like that. So he actually sits down in the market and he starts to scream out, you know, meat for sale, you know, human hamburgers, anybody wants meat for sale, you know. And they say that these demons block the sound. Like, he's screaming at the top of his voice and these demons are blocking the sound. No one can hear it. There's a crazy guy sitting there with his mouth, you know, nobody can hear him. So out of frustration, he starts to cry. You know, he just starts to weep out of pure frustration. And that's how he got his name. It's called Ever Weeping. A very famous example of a bodhisattva. And it has a nice ending, but I won't go into it. This is not... Okay. This fair damsel, the daughter of a rich merchant, sees him from the rooftop. She's like out on this parapet. And sees this guy, you know, and he's crying, you know. She just feels sorry for him. So she goes down and finds out that he needs money for offerings. So she goes and talks Dad into paying for offerings. And he gets the offering and sees emptiness and all that. meet the Lama, please open up. Nice story. This is not that kind of offer. Okay? This just means I give up myself to the service of the three jewels. I give up my life to the service of the three jewels. And that is the offering of yourself, of your body. Okay? I will be, I put myself at your service. Just use me. Okay. It's like that. Last offer, then we'll stop. Say le,
le,
chulwe,
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 chulwe.
Le means by your mind or with your mind. Chulwa means you emanate them or you send them out just with your own thoughts. You close your eyes and you do it in your own mind. And chulwa means the offering. So this is the kind of offering that you do in a fantasy. Fantasized offering. And there are 12 different kinds. And I'm not going to go through them all. It's in your reading. But I'll give you some typical ones. Okay? Maybe one is that you imagine some beautiful bodhisattva or Tara or anyone you want, and you're offering them a bathing. You're bathing them. And offering them a bath. Okay? And there's a whole process, you know, you have to bathe them the right way, and then you have to dry them the right way, and then you have to prostrate the right way, and it's very sweet, and you do it all in your mind. There's one where you offer them a beautiful palace to live in, or you cover their body with beautiful silk. You know, you can do that, you can sit there and change it, you know. Make it one, you know, dress them in one way and then just dissolve it and dress them in another way. And you can keep offering all sorts of flowers, every kind of flower you can imagine. But the point is this, it's this huge fantasized offering. And it has profound effects on your mental continuum. It has profound effects on your being. It sets you up for purification. You know, if you can do these, it sounds like something worthless, but you know how powerful fantasies can be. You know how powerful dreams can be. You know, there's some kind of thing about visualizing something and really getting into the fantasy. You know, don't just do it as an obligation. You know, get into it. Pick a bodhisattva that you really think is cool and just go through the whole thing and offer them everything. Go through the all 12 offerings. It's your meditation for this week, okay? You're going through all 12 offerings and just have a good time. I mean, that's draw. That's perfection number four. Having a good time doing a good thing is one of the six perfections. And just enjoy it. You know, get off on it. And what will happen is that it'll act itself out eventually. You'll be able to make real offerings to these bodhisattvas. And you'll find that it starts to affect your behavior. Just like all the bad fantasies that we have about saying something to somebody at work and stuff like that. You know, like you go home and you fantasize about how you're going to say it, how their face is going to go like that, you know? And what a joy it would be, you know. And so these are like real fantasies that you can carry out in your mind. Last note, and we'll stop. You will see names of bodhisattvas in the reading. Some of them are Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, Vajrapani is in there, Samantha Bhadra, like that. These are beings that you normally think of as tantric deities or angels or something like that, fully enlightened beings. In the sutra teachings, in the teachings which are not secret, they are bodhisattvas. They were bodhisattvas in the time of Buddha and later. And they were specialized in these offerings. They were like known for their ability to do these offerings, especially the last one. And you'll find there's a form of the last one which is called the unsurpassed offering. And you have to learn to do that. Okay. You'll see that. So don't get confused, okay? In the open teachings, they are bodhisattvas. In the secret teachings, I can't tell you anything. Okay? It's kind of late, so I think we'll just go straight to mandala offering. But do the fantasizing at home. You know, 12 offerings, they're listening there, and if you know, what we're talking about is actions that prepare your mind to learn compassion. If you do them, you can learn compassion. If you don't, you never will. And you'll be one of those very sad, frustrated Dharma students who couldn't do it and really didn't change much. And you don't have to be like that. You know, you have the information. And just do it. Okay. And this one, you can't stand in and have time. You can do it on the way to work. You can do it in the subway. You can do it while you're on the phone at work with your friends. Yeah. You can do it all the time, right? No problem.
Could you tell them to get the readings and the homeworks on the way out by the door?
Please pick up the readings and the homework on the... Well, by the way, the people doing that, they did two all-nighters last week, one all-nighter this week. So, or there's a couple other people, so you should thank them if you do so.
Get them out on right. By the door.
By the door.
Down park, who made to park.